your daily dose of debate, breaking news, and ooze. Uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day, a great weekend, I hope, coming up. Though it's going to be very hot here in Seattle. Uncharacteristically hot. At least that's what the weather experts say. All part of climate change. Well, we'll get to that, maybe. And one of the things that we will definitely get to is the two very disturbing stories that are riveting national attention right at the moment. One of them, the sentencing hearing, and the sentence will be meted out by Judge Peter Cahill in Minneapolis, the sentence for Derek Chauvin, who has been convicted of killing George Floyd. He will be sentenced according to the most severe charge that was prosecuted against him and for which he was found guilty, the charge of second-degree murder. He could get anywhere. The standard range would be somewhere between 12 and 40 years in prison. He has been serving time in solitary confinement, partially for his own protection in prison since his conviction in April. We will bring you all of the latest as it emerges. They right now are hearing statements from both the prosecution and for the defense. Eric Nelson, the defense attorney for Derek Chauvin, trying to make some case that his client should only get probation, meaning that he would still have the conviction, he would be held as guilty, but he wouldn't actually be spending any time in prison. The chances, according to all legal experts, of Derek Chauvin getting only probation, getting no further jail time, they're pretty much nil. He will get some jail time. The question is how much, what is just. We will bring you all that live when Judge Cahill finishes hearing these statements, which included earlier this morning a statement from Gianna, the 7-year-old daughter of George Floyd. We will bring you all of the final results as they are announced. There's also more information about the horrifying collapse of a building, a condo building in Surfside, Florida, near Miami Beach. Joe Biden spoke about that today. He was signing a bill to create a National Pulse Memorial. That was at the site of Pulse Nightclub, the shooting in Orlando that took place in 2016. You may remember that was an Islamic terrorist fanatic who came in and killed, I believe the final total was 49 people at a gay nightclub. That is becoming the Pulse Nightclub Memorial, and they're calling it the National Pulse Memorial. And while he was there signing that bill, he spoke about the latest Florida tragedy, which involves a condo building where 159 people are still unaccounted for. Four have been reported dead. Here's President Biden.
I just want to say I've spoken to Governor DeSantis. And we've provided all the help that they have, they need. We sent the best people from FEMA down there. We're going to stay with them with the disaster declaration we made, provide for everything from housing to, God forbid, whether there's a need for a moratoria for the bodies to be placed, everything in between. And but I just want to say, and I'm sure I speak for all the members of the Congress here today and all the survivors here, that it's a tough time. There's so many people waiting. Are they alive? Will it happen? And so our heart goes out to them. And the people of Florida, I've spoken to Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I've spoken to most of the folks down there and member and authority. And I promise you, the administration, the Congress are doing everything possible to be of assistance now and after this occurs, after they decide exactly what the state of play is.
Okay, it's really not a question of the state of play. I mean, one of the things that clearly has to happen is, how did this happen? Because buildings don't just collapse. There is actually talk, apparently just a few days before, there was some kind of inspection of the building. And when we know more about why that building collapse occurred, then it will be appropriate to look at some other, basically, how you can help to discourage, prevent something like this from happening ever again. Now, you may not be able to prevent it from happening ever again, but you can certainly make it less likely. It's a terrible thing, and we all depend upon the strength of the buildings we live in, go up in, use regularly. And that's one of the reasons, it seems to me, that this hits many Americans exactly where they are. Another crisis, it's the crisis at the border. Is that going to get better now that Kamala Harris has finally paid her much-discussed border visit? Today she's in El Paso, where it's just a bridge that divides the city of El Paso from the larger city, even larger city of Ciudad Juarez in Mexico. And here is what the Vice President of the United States had to say about the situation at the border that she is now in charge of responding to for the Biden administration. Listen.
My trip to Guatemala and Mexico was about addressing the root causes. The stories that I heard and the interactions that we had today reinforce the nature of those root causes. A lack of economic opportunity, very often violence, corruption, and food insecurity, and basic needs not being met, including a fear of cartels and gang violence. So the work that we have to do is the work of addressing the cause, the root causes. Otherwise, we will continue to see the effect, what is happening at the border. It is going to require, as we have been doing, a comprehensive approach that acknowledges each piece of this.
Okay, is that a dodge? Because, again, she's talking about the root cause being dysfunction and deep, deep dysfunction in countries like El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. And if we are waiting for progress on the border, for enhanced border security, to change the economic and the security and the corruption situation in countries like El Salvador, it's going to be a long wait. And it seems to me, rather than the vice president saying, well, we have to go back to the root causes, right now you've got an emergency. You have to put a Band-Aid on it. You have to put a tourniquet on it. You have to stop the situation from harming you right now. Then you can have a long-term treatment for the illness, right? But this does appear in the eyes of many people, and it's not just conservatives. It's basically most Americans. The situation is not working right now. Is it all Biden's fault? We've had problems with the border for a long time, but obviously much of this is Biden's fault because of the rhetoric that all seem to encourage people to press forward with the idea that they would eventually get legal authorization to enter the country or just slip through the cracks. We will get to the way this will play out in the election. There's a piece by Dan McLaughlin. It says, crime on the streets, racism in the schools. 2021 brings the 2022 playing field into view. We'll go into view on that, and also the Justice Department suing the state of Georgia. Why? How? How will it go? What does it mean? We'll get to that and more coming up on The MedVed Show. On the Michael Medved Show, we will keep you up to date about the sentencing of Derek Chauvin over the killing murder of George Floyd. One of the things that it seems to me is very striking about this case right now, even though it has provoked a tremendous amount of analysis and controversy and discussion regarding racial justice, racism, the equity in the United States or lack of it between black people and white people. What's been interesting to me is that with the trial itself and the question of the guilt or innocence of Officer Derek Chauvin, there has not been a great deal of race. No attempt to prove that there was a racial motivation by Derek Chauvin. And absolutely no example of people rallying to his support on a racial basis. In other words, it seems to me that even though obviously everything having to do with the case and all of the conversation that it provoked was deeply involved with questions of racial justice and fairness and equity, in the courtroom itself, and when talking about, well, will he get a 10-year sentence, which I suspect will be closer to that 10 or 12 years, but who knows, when Judge Cahill decides, and he will decide apparently at some time today, I don't think there will be reference in particular to any racial motivation, either in the sentencing, the prosecution, or the defense of racial elements to the conversation. And that, it seems to me, is a relief. There is, however, another legal proceeding that is all about race. I mean, just all about race. And it's a proceeding that surprises me, frankly, because it's not going to help anybody politically. This is not going to help the Biden administration. Frankly, I don't think it'll help the Republicans. The headline in Wall Street Journal is Justice Department sues Georgia over its new voting law. The Biden administration is suing the state of Georgia, alleging its new voting law aims to restrict the rights of black voters. Attorney General Merrick Garland said Friday. The action marks the first such federal government challenge to Republican-backed efforts in multiple states to tighten voting laws. By the way, you'll understand that this is the Wall Street Journal, and I very deliberately wanted to go to a source that would be less biased. And they say tighten voting laws. That's accurate. That's what they're talking about here. They're talking about the number of drop boxes you have and the hours with which you vote. And they are not talking about voting restrictions. That term restrictions is used almost ubiquitously by the media. They always talk about voting restrictions. And it is taken as a given that the purpose of these so-called voting restrictions, which aren't really restrictions at all, is to disfranchise black voters. And that is the basis for this suit, but it has nothing to do with the law that was actually passed in Georgia. By the way, if somebody wants to point out a restriction that that law contained, where it actually took away rights of people of color to vote, hard-won rights that were the subject of the great march on Selma at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965 and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, all of that, is that in jeopardy by the Georgia law? If so, how? 1-800-955-1776, our phone number. The lawsuit, in fact, alleges that Georgia violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that was won by Dr. King. And they voted Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act when it enacted changes to the state's election requirements, including altering how people cast absentee ballots and where people can drop off their ballots, Justice Department officials said. A Republican Governor Brian Kemp signed the new law in March after it was passed by the GOP-dominated legislature. Republicans said the changes were needed to restore confidence after voters in the among voters in the integrity of Georgia elections following the recent tumultuous political season. Many of that law's provisions made it harder for people to vote, Merrick Garland said, the attorney general, in announcing the new lawsuit. He added, the rights of all eligible citizens to vote are the central pillars of our democracy. He's right about that. But where are the rights being taken away? Now, it may be that it would make voting less convenient for people, which I think is a mistake. But does that involve a violation of a constitutional right to say that you're going to have one drop box per county? You still can get your mail-in ballot in through the mail. And the idea that this is going to be reducing vote share or of any kind in any way, all we've had, despite all the complaints of disfranchisement, is the last election in Georgia where Stacey Abrams ran for governor. She lost by 50,000 votes, but she ran for governor. She got record black turnouts for a gubernatorial election. And this time, where Biden did win the state by 12,000 votes, there were record turnouts. There was zero evidence of efforts at or achievement of voting suppression of any kind. And it's rather important to keep in mind, don't you think? Governor Kemp spoke about, in reaction to the lawsuit from the Justice Department, that his government is going to have to defend. He's also having to defend his term as governor. He's running for re-election, and he is clearly going to be vigorously opposed, probably by Stacey Abrams and all the Democrats and Donald Trump, who wants to knock him out of office. In any event, Governor Kemp said on Twitter, this lawsuit is born out of the lies and misinformation the Biden administration has pushed against Georgia's Election Integrity Act from the start. The Speaker of the Georgia House, who is also, of course, a Republican, said Georgia's Election Integrity Act makes voting more accessible and secure. We will vigorously defend our system of free and fair elections. The Justice Department's suit takes particular aim at the changes that the state law, known as SB 202, makes to absentee voting, including those that prohibit election officials from distributing unsolicited absentee ballots and those that limit the number of drop boxes for those ballots. The department says black Americans are more likely to use these provisions than white voters. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act says states cannot impose any rule, quote, which results in a denial or abridgment of the right to vote on the basis of race. The idea that there is anything in the Georgia bill that they are now challenging that leads to the denial or abridgment of the right to vote is ludicrous, downright ludicrous. So how will this play out in 2022? Especially the elections that are going on and the controversies going on right now in 2021. We'll talk about that with Dan McLaughlin of the National Review. Michael Medved show, a little bit later, we're going to be reviewing the big new epic production, F9, which is either the ninth or, depending on how you count them, the 10th of the Fast and Furious series, and certainly the longest of them. It's 2.5 hours. We'll be reviewing that, and we'll be reviewing also a big new Pixar Disney film that probably will get Oscar consideration for Best Animated Movie. It's called Luca. But first up, not a cartoon and not a violent Fast and Furious epic, but a looming election in 2022. And there was just a great headline that I loved. The headline says, crime on the streets, racism in the schools, 2021 brings the 2022 playing field into view. That headline appeared in National Review, and over at National Review, Dan McLaughlin is a senior writer. He is also a former attorney, you could say recovering attorney in New York City, and a contributing editor of Red State and a columnist at The Federalist. Dan, it's great to speak to you here.
Great to be here.
Well, thank you so much. Okay, first of all, with everybody waiting on tenterhooks about the George Floyd, Derek Chauvin verdict, which should be coming out soon, politically, both the things that you mentioned, crime on the streets and racism in the schools, those issues are probably not going to help Joe Biden and the Democrats, are they?
There's still a long way to the midterms to see how badly the Democrats will get on the wrong side of these things or if they can find a way to stay on the right side of them. Crime shouldn't be it shouldn't be something that Joe Biden is unable to handle. I mean, Biden was very much a tough on crime guy, a pro law enforcement guy back in the 90s. But he has really kind of lost the handle on his party. He's letting them drive him. And so, you know, that as you see spiking crime rates, particularly in cities around the country, you know, Biden is not putting out a message that is getting heard over many of the local Democrats who are trying to, you know, still push things like defund the police. And yet at the same time, what we see at the local level is that even in Democratic primaries, even the Democrats' own voters, you know, the people who want defund the police are really a minority of those voters, and an awful lot of, you know, for example, working class Black and Hispanic voters, they want cops in their neighborhoods.
You make the point that the defund the police segment of that big elect list of candidates for mayor of New York didn't do particularly well. The leader and the apparent winner is Eric Adams, who's a former cop. Given that, isn't it striking that even on what Joe Biden obviously meant to be a big victory, an example of bipartisanship, the agreement on the infrastructure bill, he's being slammed by members of his own party? How does that play?
Yeah, and not only is he being slammed by members of his own party, but he almost immediately after announcing the agreement, he pulled the rug out from under the Republicans who he was cutting a deal with by saying, you know what, they're going to do this bipartisan deal with me, but we're not even going to bring it up for a vote until we also get the stuff that we want on a straight party line vote. So, you know, he's saying, well, yeah, what you're going to give me, we'll bank that, but then we'll take the rest anyway. So I think Biden, you know, every time Biden's old instincts as a compromiser and, you know, as a moderate on some issues, every time that those kind of bubble up, he gets pulled around by his party and he ends up tossing them aside. I think he just doesn't stand in the wind anymore.
Okay, and what is going to happen in terms of the announcement today that the Justice Department is suing Georgia to overturn the new Voting Regulation Act? It is not a Voting Restriction Act. The likelihood that Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice are going to go forward, probably sue some other states as well. That surely can't be popular in a country where 80% of people and 60% of Democrats want to see voter ID.
Yeah, and it's also going to be some of these suits are really going to be an uphill battle legally, and they may get more uphill next week. The thing that's really strange to me is the Supreme Court still has a Voting Rights Act case on its docket that it will decide almost certainly Monday or Tuesday. And it seems to me if I was a Justice Department lawyer trying to figure out how to come up with the best legal strategy to go forward in these things, I would just wait a couple of days to see what the court's going to do. Because, you know, even though it's not on exactly all fours with what they're complaining about in Georgia, you know, a couple of the big issues that are at stake in the Arizona case are going to have some overlap with a lot of these lawsuits.
Yeah. Now, you bring up in your column, and it's very interesting, Loudoun County, Virginia, which is one of the fastest growing counties in the country. It is the highest median income, I believe, of any county in the country. It's 400,000 people. They tend to be very prosperous, well-educated. And it's a county that has been moving heavily in a Democratic direction. That could decide whether Loudoun County is competitive or not, whether the Glenn Youngkin, who is the Republican running to recapture the governorship, has any shot in Virginia, right?
Yeah, I really think Loudoun is a great example of a place that Republicans need to not necessarily win, but they need to be competitive there again if they're going to start winning things like governor's races in Virginia. It's definitely, you know, it's a county that was won by Bob McDonnell when he was elected governor 8 years ago, or 12 years ago. And, you know, it's a county that George W. Bush won. And it's been drifting. And during Trump's presidency, it sort of lurched very, very hard in the Democrats' direction. But, you know, there's this big backlash right now building with the and starting to explode into public view against the teaching of critical race theory and other kind of woke ideas in the Loudoun County public schools. And I think that, you know, I think a lot of the simmering frustration over what's being taught in the schools is also being given extra power by the frustration of parents over the schools not opening. And so there's a sense that, you know, a lot of these parents, they were trying to get their kids back into school. It took a long time, perhaps because the parents were home with the kids. They got a better exposure to what their kids were being taught. And so some of that frustration is just boiling up right now.
That frustration, I mean, the polling they have so far between Glenn Youngkin and Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic, presumptive Democratic nominee, race has been polling very closely. And could this be maybe a surprising swing in the Republican direction setting up 2022?
I mean, I think both parties are going to see this as a test case. And McAuliffe is a test case because, of course, he is a guy who has sort of an old school Clinton, crony, a guy who is, you know, who presents himself as being fairly moderate in some ways, but has also been kind of surfing with the direction of his party. And Youngkin, of course, is a, you know, a rookie politician. So that means that he has a little bit more room to define himself by what he wants to pick fights over. So I think there really is a battleground there, you know, that will be replayed in a lot of like House districts around the country that the Democrats hold right now that they have taken away just, you know, in the last 4 years or so from the Republicans, including the House district, the Virginia's 10th district, which includes Loudoun County.
It's all a fascinating game as it unfolds, and a very important one. Dan McLaughlin of National Review, thanks for coming up. Coming back, Derek Chauvin, for the first time in his criminal proceedings, has spoken for himself. So what exactly did he have to say? We will get to that directly on The Michael Medved Show. Medved Show, entire nation is riveted by the proceedings in Minnesota, where they are hearing arguments on both sides for the defense and for the prosecution for a maximum sentence or a minimum sentence. Derek Chauvin's attorney is asking that he get only probation and time served. In other words, that he be released from jail and have a very stringent, that's the word that they used, probation penalty. But, of course, the attorneys for the state attorney general's office are calling for a much longer sentence, close to the maximum that they could give, of 40 years. Now, according to the Washington Post, there's a lot of hesitation on the part of the prosecution, because if they got that kind of sentence that seemed to be out of proportion for somebody who has no criminal record, and Derek Chauvin has no criminal record, that if they got a sentence for more than 30 years, it would be likely overturned. And you can only imagine the kind of reaction, the kind of passionate indignation that would inspire. Officer Chauvin did not speak at all during his trial. He had the option to. He could have, but that would have meant that he would have had to submit to cross-examination. and his attorneys decided not to do that. And he did speak today to Judge Cahill regarding his sentence, and it sounded moments ago like this.
Very briefly, though, I do want to give my condolences to the Floyd family. There's going to be some other information in the future that would be of interest, and I hope things will give you some peace of mind. Thank you.
That was it. And I do not know, I don't think anybody knows what information he is thinking of that could give the Floyd family peace of mind. Look, this is a very serious matter, and it is Attorney General of the state of Minnesota, Keith Ellison, a former U.S. congressman and a former candidate to be Democratic national chair. He didn't make it. He says, we're not looking for revenge. We're looking at the seriousness of what happened. And part of their argument calling for the maximum sentence is the damage not only to the Floyd family. They began with some testimony by Floyd's 7-year-old daughter, I believe one of his 5 children. And she spoke, and of course it was terrifying and horrible because she's a child. She's 7 years old, and she misses her daddy. And Eric Nelson, the attorney for Derek Chauvin, said, Mr. Chauvin is not the average offender. Prior to this incident, Mr. Chauvin led a hardworking, law-abiding life and has experienced no legal issues until the point of his arrest. Will that be relevant? We shall see. In the other huge controversy emerging today, this is what the announcement sounded like by Merrick Garland, the Attorney General of the United States, chief law enforcement officer of the country, announcing his new lawsuit against the state of Georgia. 7A.
Today, the Department of Justice is suing the state of Georgia. Our complaint alleges that recent changes to Georgia's election laws were enacted with the purpose of denying or abridging the right of black Georgians to vote on account of their race or color in violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
Okay, this is outrageous, and it sounds not like a legal argument so much as a Democratic Party talking point. And one of the things that Joe Biden had promised was that the Justice Department wouldn't be used for partisan purposes. This appears to be the use for the partisan purposes. Here comes the sentencing of Derek Chauvin. We'll go directly to it.
Analysis. It's applying the rule of law to the facts of an individual and specific case. And that is why, as opposed to trying to be being profound here on the record, I prefer that you read the legal analysis that explains how I determine the sentence in this case. What the case is, or what the sentence is not based on, is emotion or sympathy. But at the same time, I want to acknowledge the deep and tremendous pain that all the families are feeling, especially the Floyd family. You have our sympathies. And I acknowledge and hear the pain that you are feeling.
This is Judge Peter Cahill.
I acknowledge the pain not only of those in this courtroom, but the Floyd family who are outside this courtroom and other members of the community. It has been painful throughout Hennepin County, throughout the state of Minnesota, and even the country. But most importantly, we need to recognize the pain of the Floyd family. I'm not going to attempt to be profound or clever, because it's not the appropriate time. I I'm not basing my sentence also on public opinion. I'm not basing it on any attempt to send any messages. A trial court judge, the job of a trial court judge, is to apply the law to specific facts and to deal with individual cases. And so, Mr. Chauvin, as to count one, based on the verdict of the jury finding you guilty of unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony under Minnesota Statute 609.19 subdivision 2 paren 1, it is the judgment of the court that you now stand convicted of that offense. Pursuant to Minnesota Statute Section 60904, counts 2 and 3 will remain unadjudicated as they are lesser offenses of count 1. As sentence for count 1, the court commits you to the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections for a period of 270 months. That's 270. That is a 10-year addition to the presumptive sentence of 150 months. This is based on your abuse of a position of trust and authority, and also the particular cruelty shown to George Floyd. You are granted credit for 199 days already served. Pay the mandatory surcharge of $78 to be paid from prison wages. You're prohibited from possessing firearms, ammunition, or explosives for the remainder of your life. Provide a DNA sample as required by law. Register as a predatory offender as required by law. And you will receive a copy of the order and also the attached memorandum explaining the court's analysis. Anything further from the state?
If this needs to be said, we just ask that it be executed forthwith.
Defendant is remanded to the custody of the sheriff to be transported back to the DOC or whichever custody is currently holding him. Anything for the defense?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. We are adjourned.
The sentence, as I think very much people anticipated, the exact sentence he said, 270 months. Is that correct, Jeremy? What it came to? 270 months, so you can do the math. We're talking about a very substantial sentence, and a sentence that would be on the higher range of what was due to happen. Now, there are going to be appeals, not just of the sentence, but there was an issue with one of the jurors who had said that he had not participated in any demonstrations in response to the death of George Floyd, but had in fact been photographed wearing a Black Lives Matter t-shirt. I don't think that appeal is likely to go anywhere. There can be very little satisfaction with this, but at least some gratitude that with a very serious and very deep sentence and a very long sentence, that the chances for civil unrest, the chances for continued agitation on this specific tragic crime will not be going forward, God willing, for this greatest nation on God's green earth.